Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley and I'm super excited for this week's show because I'm talking about Never Been Kissed, an insane movie from 1999, and I'm joined for this very special episode by Rosalie Lewis. Hi Rosalie.
Hi Patrick.
Lest anyone doubt my commitment to F This Movie, I'm recording this episode with COVID, so if I'm off my game a little bit, I apologize, but I wanted to make sure we got a new episode out this week, so thank you for, Rosalie, we had to reschedule this from yesterday, and you've been very patient with me, so thank you.
Well, I absolutely would have waited as long as it takes to talk about this movie, and I am very sorry that you and your household have succumbed.
Yeah.
As I recall, my very first, like, solo on the podcast, not part of the big, you know, group F This Movie, you had to postpone because I had COVID. So
I believe you are correct. That was for the old guard, right?
I know. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're still battling this stupidity that is COVID-19. But
I know. I thought we'd be recording the show in person, and yet here we are over Skype again.
Oh, well.
Anyway, Rosalie, have you seen anything good lately?
Oh, Patrick, I've been watching all kinds of fun stuff.
Sweet.
So, I will start with the thing I've watched most recently, and that is last night I watched Deep Water.
Oh, yes.
The Ben Affleck, Ana de Armas, Adrian Lyne directed erotic thriller. I enjoyed it quite a bit, and I also had not yet read Rob's review when I watched it, because I always try to go in as, like, spoiler-free as possible to movies and then
read
the reviews afterwards. So it was fun to read his reactions and his descriptions, and, you know, everything he says is true. Yeah, very enjoyable movie. Have you seen it yet yourself?
I did. I was fortunate enough to watch a screener a little bit early. I'm maybe not quite as positive on it as everybody else, although I did enjoy watching Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas. I thought they were both really good in the movie. I just thought it wasn't, maybe it's the kind of movie I need to see again, because maybe I was expecting one thing and it delivered another. I think that's part of it.
Sure.
I think I was expecting more of a traditional, like, erotic thriller, and that's not really what the movie is. It's more just about a fucked up marriage.
Yeah.
And on that level, I thought it was interesting. I was never bored. I enjoyed all the actors. I enjoyed all the performances. I liked it. I just wanted to love it, and I'm not there yet.
Totally understood. Actually, yeah, I mean, I didn't exactly know what to expect in terms of, like, plot. I've seen a lot of Adrian Lyne's other work and love a lot of it, although I think Indecent Proposal is probably not that great.
No, it's
but,
not.
still worth watching just for the weirdness of it. It's definitely a departure from those types of movies, but it was fun to see these two A-level actors and, you know, a very good supporting cast, too. Tracy Letts, I really liked in this, too.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting premise. Like, it's a very much like a movie for grown-ups about marriage, about relationships, about obsession. And it's fun to watch that play out, even if the stakes aren't what we were expecting going in.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it, in some ways it felt a little bit like an episode of Prestige TV, because that's where we typically tend to see more of this kind of theme.
Right.
But yeah, I really liked it. And it's under 2 hours. Like, who does that anymore?
You gotta like that. I didn't realize until I saw it written out somewhere that Adrian Lyne hasn't made a movie since Unfaithful in 2002.
True. That is true.
That's bananas.
Yeah, it's crazy. I hope he makes them more frequently, although, you know, I mean, at least he's waiting for, like, the quality scripts to come along, so
sure.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized until watching the credits that Sam Levinson co-wrote the script for it, or that it was based on a Patricia Highsmith novel. So at least the source material, you know, comes from a very, very good place.
Right.
Sam Levinson, I haven't seen any of Euphoria, so I don't have a ton to go off of. And I didn't see Malcolm and Marie. I just remembered the unbearable discourse around it. But yeah, it's interesting to see him kind of be more of a behind-the-scenes player in this instance, and I thought the script was pretty solid.
Yeah, I'm a little mixed on Euphoria. It's entertaining in, like, kind of a trashy way, but
sure.
I was not a fan of Malcolm and Marie. I forgot that was him.
Yeah. The next movie I will talk about that I saw was Chan is Missing, written about by our very own Anthony King on the site, probably almost like a year and a half ago, probably. It's been a long time. It's been a while. but Chan is Missing is coming to the Criterion Collection. And so it's right now featured on the Criterion Channel. And if you haven't seen it, this is a really just interesting movie. It's, I believe, Wayne Wang's debut feature, I want to say.
I think you're right about that.
From 1982. It's shot in black and white. Feels very, like, of a piece with almost like 90s independent cinema in a lot of ways because it's very talky. There is a plot to some extent, like, the title is kind of the plot, like this guy that they know is missing. And it's these two cabbies that are kind of searching San Francisco to try to find him because he's made off with $4,000 that they gave him to like help start a new cab company. But over the course of the movie, they don't necessarily get a ton of answers, but each person they talk to gives them another piece of the puzzle of who they think Chan was as a person. And it also kind of, you know, goes through what Chinese Americans were dealing with at the time and probably still to some extent are. So yeah, just a really interesting movie. And I think, you know, pretty low budget, but really makes the most of what it has. It's also just kind of fun to see San Francisco in 1982. And like, you know, I've been there in the fairly recent past and it has changed a lot since then. So highly recommended that one. Have you seen that one, Patrick?
I have not. I wanted to after Anthony wrote about it, and I didn't realize that it was already on the Criterion Channel. I saw the announcement that they were putting it out, which was very exciting.
Yeah, for sure.
So I now have a way of seeing it, which is kind of nice. That way I'm not blind buying the Blu-ray.
Yeah. I decided after watching, I definitely will pick up the Blu-ray when it comes out. And it's another one that, you know, if you don't have a lot of time on your hands, I guess unlike Patrick right now with his COVID status, you can still make time for this one easily because it's 76 minutes, so it flies by.
Nice.
Yeah. Let's see. So very much changing gears then. I have been watching a lot of rom-coms recently.
Oh, boy.
Partly in preparation for the show, partly because I just was in the mood to watch rom-coms. Like, I, you know, I go through these phases of, like, all these serious movies or a lot of, like, thrillers, or right now it's been a lot of Oscar prep, you know.
Yeah.
So it was fun to kind of take a break from that. And one of the movies that I discovered that I had completely written off when it came out was 27 Dresses. I was very pleasantly surprised. Like, it's still not, you know, a five-star film or anything like that, but I definitely think that Katherine Heigl was done dirty. She's very fun and charming in this movie. She's not this like hysterical, you know, person that I expected the movie to be about, of like, she's so desperate to get married. That's really not the case. That is a topic that comes up, but it's more just like, you know, she enjoys the idea of love and romance, and she loves going to weddings, and she loves helping her friends with it. And so it's very interesting. And it's directed by Anne Fletcher, who also did The Proposal, which is another, I would say, above average rom-com of recent years.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really found it enjoyable. James Marsden is fun in it. Judy Greer plays like the best friend. And then of course, Edward Burns is like one of the love interests in this movie, which I did not realize. So yeah, there's a lot to love about this one.
I haven't seen it since the weekend it opened. Erica and I saw it theatrically, and then I haven't seen it since. So you're talking me into a revisit. I remember thinking like, that was cute, you know, like, I don't remember much about it. I remember Edward Burns being in it, that's about it, and I had no idea. I just pulled up the Wikipedia page just to see what year it came out. This movie was like a monster hit. It made almost $200 million.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? Like, people think of Katherine Heigl and they're like, ooh, like, box office poison almost, but really, she had a very, she helmed a successful string of movies, and I'm not entirely sure why that narrative has arisen about her, because I mean, I didn't watch Grey's Anatomy, so I can't really speak to her on that show, but yeah, I thought she was very good in it. And, you know, it's not amazing, but if you enjoy romantic comedies, it's definitely worth checking out.
I feel like around the time of Knocked Up, like some stories came out from the dudes in that movie that was like, she was difficult. She wasn't like one of the guys. And I don't know if that hurt her career. I don't know if that just confirmed, because I think there were rumors of her being, you know, quote unquote, difficult on the set of Grey's Anatomy as well. So I don't know how much of that has to do with her film career stalling out a little bit, but you're right. I mean, she was in a couple of big, big movies, and then all of a sudden it was like kind of nothing.
Right. Yeah, it's very strange. Yeah. Another one, totally different now, that I watched that's recent, and this one I think you probably have seen, Patrick, is Fresh. Did you watch this yet?
I did.
What did you think of it?
Maybe this is just the COVID talking. This is another one that I'm a little bit out of step with what I've seen on social media in terms of, like, Rob DiCristino wrote a review of this one as well, and I think I'm more in line with his feelings on it, if you read the review, because a lot of what I've seen on Twitter has been very, very celebratory of Fresh, and I kind of thought it was okay.
Sure. It's funny because I think the title is not an accurate summation of the type of movie we get. It's not a fresh concept, but I thought it was a fun, like, you know, just a good, somewhat low stakes, high concept horror movie with some comedy thrown in. And I really enjoy the premise. I guess maybe I shouldn't say it's a horror movie, but hopefully people know that by the poster. But, you know, the movie starts out as one thing, and it actually, because I've been watching rom-coms, I was like, oh, this kind of feels like a rom-com. And then it takes a turn and goes into decidedly different territory. But at its heart, it still has a little bit of those rom-com tendencies, which I think makes it a little bit fun. And, of course, like, there's over-the-top stuff. So I don't know. There's the dancing sequence. That was super fun. Like, yes, it was done in Ex Machina, but that's okay. I don't know. It was a good time. I mean, I'm not going to say, like, they should make 10 sequels or anything. But, right. You know, it was nice to have a horror movie that's not elevated horror and that's not, you know, part of a gigantic franchise that I feel obligated to watch all the prequels and sequels.
Right. Well, yeah, that makes sense. I thought it had a lot of stuff going for it. I like Sebastian Stan. I really liked Daisy Edgar Jones, who I've never seen in anything before. This was my introduction to her. It looks like maybe she's done a lot of, like, series television. This was the first movie I had ever seen her in, and I thought she was really great.
Yeah, I also liked, although she didn't get as much screen time as I would have liked, Jonica Gibbs, who plays
the best friend. Yeah.
She was really good. I actually would have enjoyed it if she was the star of the movie. But
sure.
Yeah. I thought, yeah, pretty good cast and fun material for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Scrolling through, cause I don't want to talk about like all the same movies everybody else has probably already seen and talked about ad nauseum. So I guess the last one I will talk about is a movie called Chutney Popcorn. And this is another one that I watched kind of thinking it was a romantic comedy. It's not really that, though. It's more of a family slash culture clash comedy called Chutney Popcorn. And it's directed by Nisha Ganatra, and she also stars in it. And I believe this was her debut as well. And it came out in 99, so like the movie we're going to be talking about.
Oh, very nice.
And it's basically, it's about a young woman who lives in New York, and she's Indian American. Her sister is getting married, and her mom is super excited because she thinks, you know, that both of her daughters should be married and having children. And Rena and her girlfriend just moved in together, and the girlfriend is played by Jill Hennessy, who I think, you know, is a name that people might recognize. And basically her sister discovers after getting married that she and her husband can't have kids of their own. And so after a lot of kind of like back and forth, Rena kind of impulsively says, oh, well, maybe I could be a surrogate for you. And everybody doubts it because she's like the, you know, sort of not outcast, but like the sister that the rest of the family kind of roll their eyes about. But through this movie, like, and through this story, she kind of becomes something more in her family's eyes and kind of leads to more acceptance for her relationship and the fact that she's a lesbian and all of this. And so it's a really interesting time capsule in a way, because it is from 99, so there are certain things in it that you're like, okay, yeah, that feels like 1999 politics and right, you know, the narrative that was going on at the time. But it's a fun and different movie than what we're used to seeing when it comes to, I think, queer cinema in particular. So I really enjoyed that, and just kind of seeing it through that, like, mixed culture lens too. You know, the fact that it stars and is written by and is directed by somebody who has had similar experiences to this, I think adds some authenticity to what could otherwise kind of feel like a sitcom premise in a way. But it really, you know, is a sweet film, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. And so, yeah, I would highly recommend it. I believe it's on Tubi TV, and it might be on some other platforms as well. But
I thought for sure that was going to be a Criterion Channel one, because it sounds like it's got Criterion Channel written all over it.
No, I think it's it might even be on Amazon Prime right now. So give it a watch.
I remember the title really well. I've never seen it.
Yeah, it was a cute one. What about you, Patrick? What have you been watching?
Oh, gosh. Everything I've seen has been through the fog of COVID. So yesterday I watched Cop Shop, which is the new Joe Carnahan movie. And I've been a Joe Carnahan fan since probably Narc in the early 2000s. I admit that I've fallen off a little bit because I didn't see, I want to say it was Boss Level was his movie before this that was on Hulu. And I kind of avoided that one. But I mean, I love Narc and I love Smokin' Aces and I love his A-Team and the Liam Neeson one, The Gray. He's got a bunch of really cool movies. So I was looking forward to Cop Shop. It's a mixed bag. I used to really like Frank Grillo. My feelings about Frank Grillo have changed in the last year or so. But on the plus side, I've grown a new affection for Gerard Butler, especially when he's in like scumbag mode, which he is in Cop Shop. He's definitely in like Den of Thieves mode. And that is the Gerard Butler I can get behind. So he is great fun to watch. And give me a second because I didn't pull up the movie, but I want to point out the woman who plays the cop, who's sort of the hero of the whole thing. Her name is Alexis Lauder, and she's really great as well. So I think it's worth watching just for some of the turns that it takes and the performances of Gerard Butler and Alexis Lauder. If you're a Joe Carnahan fan, I think it's pretty solid. I think it's available for rent now. I actually watched it on Peacock. It's streaming there. But it's, I think it's worth a look. I watched a movie that I thought we were going to talk about, and maybe we're not, but it might be my least favorite movie of 2022 so far.
Oh, no.
And that is another movie on Peacock, a little movie called Marry Me. Have you watched that yet?
Oh, I've watched it. I also thought we were going to talk about it, so I wanted to make sure you'd seen it before I brought it up.
Oh, but I appreciate it. What are your feelings on Marry Me?
All right. So, yes, I did text you and at one point say we should do a podcast about Marry Me before either one of us had seen it. And you probably wisely said, maybe let's wait until we watch it to see if there's a podcast there. It's not as good as I hoped, but I actually liked it okay. I think I gave it like 3 stars, 3.5 maybe, which is probably too generous, but that's okay. I agree that it's a ridiculous concept. I think everybody would, because basically if you've seen the trailer, you know, she proposes to, or actually Owen Wilson is holding a sign at a concert that says marry me, and she marries him on the spot at the concert. So yeah, it is on its face ridiculous. Here's why I liked it more than maybe I should have. I feel like it's kind of amazing that at this point in time, Jennifer Lopez, who is 52 years old, is helming a romantic comedy, like, that isn't talking about how she's old or past her prime.
And sure.
That is consistently, for at least 20, if not more years, been making romantic comedies. And some of them aren't great. I actually watched just about every single one that I could get my hands on in the last few months here. But some of them are pretty great. Like, She is very charismatic, and I think that at a time when, like, a lot of women in Hollywood get written off for these types of roles and have to become, like, the mom character or, like, the woman going through a midlife crisis character at a certain point, she has never done that, and she is still able to helm a movie like this. And, yes, people, like, are surprised, but not because it's her. They're surprised because it's a weird premise for a movie. And Owen Wilson, you know, isn't that young either. Like, he's 53. So it's two people over 50 making a movie that's not
right
like, for the over 50.
Right.
Kind of cool.
Yeah, I feel like the, you know, I'm thinking of something like Random Hearts with Harrison Ford and Kristin Scott Thomas, and they were probably around the same age, and like that was a movie for our parents. Like, that was not a movie for us.
Yeah.
And yeah, this movie isn't really about their ages, and it's not about like, this is our last possible chance at love. I give it credit for that, and I think if you're a big Jennifer Lopez fan, there's a lot to like in this movie. One of my issues with it, I have nothing against Jennifer Lopez. I agree with you. Like, she's good in the movie, and she sings, and she dances, and she wears all kinds of outfits. And, like, I object to the fact that it seems constructed as, like, a promo reel for her. Like, it's not a movie so much as it is, like, this weird clip reel for Jennifer Lopez, where it's just like, buy her new album, go see her in concert, see her movie. The premise is ridiculous. I didn't know until the end credits that it's based on a graphic novel. I wanted to accuse the screenwriters of like shooting their first draft, but apparently it's based on a graphic novel, so I can only accuse the author of the graphic novel, whose name I don't have in front of me, of coming up with this ridiculous premise. And like, there was a lot of stuff I didn't like in the movie, and I'm being way too hard on it, because to say it's my least favorite movie of 2022 is like, it's my least favorite of five movies that I've seen this year. You know, like, I haven't seen that many 2022 releases.
Yeah.
I all the stuff where it's like, it's switching to phones and Instagram live feeds, and it's like, is this how we process the world now? I really didn't like all that stuff. I get what it's trying to do, but it's never really confronting any of the questions that it raises. Like, you would almost want to say, like, this is what it's like for her, and that's very difficult, and this is, you know, she's constantly being filmed, and she constantly has to create content for her Instagram live, and isn't that difficult? But instead, the movie is like, isn't it awful to fly in coach? And aren't regular people the worst? Like, it's this weird fantasy where we're meant to identify with the billionaire pop star instead of the Owen Wilson, I'm just a regular guy, going through this the way that, like, the closest parallel would be something like Notting Hill. Mm-hmm. Which has a similar sort of premise in terms of like, regular person dates superstar, problems ensue. I appreciate a romantic comedy that devotes time to like, hey, let's get to know each other.
Sure.
And this movie does that to its credit. You know, a lot of the movie is like, let's just spend time together and like each other before we have to like declare love for one another. And you know, it does it in reverse, where it's like they get married first and then they get to know each other. So it's like a reality show in that way. But I give it credit for that. There was just all this other stuff that I thought the movie was like approaching in a wrongheaded way.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I think the best J-Lo rom-coms are actually the ones where she's playing the normal person who's like trying to succeed in a world where people are like looking down on her. So I was going to give you, if you're up for it, my like top five Jennifer Lopez rom-coms.
I'm so up for it, because I'm wondering how many of them I've seen.
I mean, I'm guessing probably not that many. So I'm going to put at number five, Second Act.
Okay. Didn't see that one.
This is one that came out in 2018 and did surprisingly well at the box office. But I say surprisingly well. She always does well at the box office. It's just people always assume her movies are going to be garbage. They're not always. so that's my number five. I'm going to say my number four is going to be, hold your breath, Geely.
Interesting.
This is a controversial choice.
No, I'm on board for this. I don't hate that movie.
Okay. I watched it for the first time in preparation for us talking about Marry Me, because I was like, I need to see as many Lopez's movies as possible. And I expected it to be bad. I think I gave it 4 out of 5 stars.
Oh, wow.
I really went for this movie. I understand there are some severely problematic elements, so I want to acknowledge that right up front. There are some problems. However, I thought her and Ben had great chemistry, not necessarily of the romantic type, but I enjoyed their banter. I enjoyed the writing in this movie. I understand there's a director's cut that never was, like, seen that doesn't have necessarily the ending of them, spoiler alert, getting together, seemingly. Which is weird, because if you've seen the movie, she's a lesbian.
if it were to cut out all the Justin Bartha stuff, that would be a better director's cut.
The less said about that, the better. But... Yeah, I don't know. It was a very enjoyable movie, and there's that whole scene of her, like, doing yoga and talking about her vagina, and,
sure,
you know, that sounds really trashy, but it's a very good scene, and I enjoyed it a lot. So, I don't know. I really liked this movie. So that's my number 4. My number 3, I'm going to go with, now I'm debating here. Let's put Geely ahead of my Geely is my number 3. I'm gonna go
racing up the charts. I love it.
Here. Number 4 will be Marry Me, because we just talked about that. And so number 2, I'm gonna go with Made in Manhattan. This movie is so charming, and guess what? It's directed by Wayne Wang, who we just talked about earlier.
I know. Missing.
Really, really solid romantic comedy. 2002, she's in it with Ralph Fiennes. There's some social commentary, there's some socioeconomic stuff going on, and it's just really, really good. And it has a great supporting cast, including the late great Bob Hoskins, who is wonderful. And then my number 1 is Out of Sight, which I realize is really more of a crime movie, but nonetheless, some very smoldering scenes between J-Lo and George Clooney, so I think it counts. I'm making that my number.
Out of Sight rules, and it's so good. It's playing near us in the coming weeks.
Ooh, all right. I'm going to have to make sure I go to that.
I think it's the first Wednesday in April. It's the Critics Classic movie.
Sweet.
At Oak Grove. All right.
Look in my calendar.
Yeah, that movie was huge because it was Steven Soderbergh's comeback. It was like the arrival of Jennifer Lopez as a serious actor. It was Clooney sort of bouncing back post Batman and Robin. Like, there's all this stuff that Out of Sight did so well. No mention of The Wedding Planner, which is maybe the only other J-Lo rom-com that I've seen.
Well, I was going to do my least favorite next.
Oh, yes. I can't wait. This is great. So Marry Me is better than The Wedding Planner? This is not...
In my opinion, yes.
All right.
So my third least favorite is The Wedding Planner.
Okay. I was not a fan of that movie either.
My second least favorite is The Backup Plan. And in that movie,
J-Lo
decides that she's never going to find the right guy. And she really wants to have a baby. So she gets artificially inseminated. And then walking out of the doctor's office, she tries to get in a cab. And a guy tries to steal her cab. And then, of course, those two get together, and he's, like, her perfect one. But she's pregnant.
What?
And he's not going to take that well, but even though it's not his kid and he has nothing to do with it. Anyways, so that's my second least favorite. And then my first least favorite is Monster-in-Law, which I wanted to love this movie so much. And it even stars Michael Vartan, who's in Never Been Kissed, in a role I can't wait to talk about. but this movie is a complete waste of Jane Fonda. She is completely ridiculous and unhinged in this movie. Nobody could possibly like this woman. And Adam Scott is underutilized, even though he's fun for what he's in. Will Arnett is underutilized. Elaine Stritch is in this. Like, it has a cast that should be amazing. And the material just sucked. So that's my number one least favorite J-Lo.
All right. So that's your least favorite, not your
yes.
not your favorite of your least favorite.
No, I got was, it. I was going in reverse order, I guess.
Got it.
My
okay.
third is like the best of the three. Anyway.
Got it. No, I'm glad you did so much preparation for this. This
I
is
did
great.
A lot of
thinking. Yeah, you really came to play with the J-Lo filmography.
I did.
Wow. Okay. So I have one more movie that I'll just talk briefly about so we can get into Never Been Kissed. And that is, more than anything, these last couple of weeks, I've been looking forward to seeing X, the new Ty West movie. And then
so bad.
The night that I was planning to go, was when I started feeling symptoms and both of my kids had tested positive, and so I was like, well, rather, even though I tested negative that day, I was like, well, rather than risk it, I'm just not going to go and not infect other people at the movie theater. So I still haven't seen X. So our consolation prize was Erica and I this weekend rented Studio 666 on Amazon, which is the new Foo Fighters horror movie.
Oh, I've seen some YouTube ads for this. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's if you're a Foo Fighters fan or a horror fan, I think it's fun, and that's probably the most generous word I can use to describe it.
All right.
I feel like I saw on Twitter somewhere, somebody said, like, why is this thing almost 2 hours? It should be a sketch. And they might not be totally wrong. It's probably a half an hour too long. Had they cut down a lot of the fat, I think there's a really fun, like, 85-minute movie in here. But it's essentially the Foo Fighters go to this house to record their new album, and Dave Grohl gets possessed by a demon and starts killing everyone. And the gore gags are really spectacular. It's fun to watch the band act, you know, because they're all, like, pretty good at it. Dave Grohl especially is sort of the most accomplished of them all as an actor. But they're all just clearly having a really good time being in this big, splattery, messy horror movie. I enjoyed it. I just wish it was way shorter.
Yeah. Sometimes too much of a good thing turns it into not so good of a thing.
Yeah, it's just there's a lot of kind of extra padding, and it takes maybe too long to get where it needs to go, and then it drags out the conclusion, and the ending is kind of a whimper instead of it's a little bit of a mess. But again, I have so much goodwill for the thing and for the band that I was able to enjoy myself.
Well, it sounds like a reasonable recommendation.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
maybe I'll check it out when it hits streaming. Or is it streaming already?
Well, you can rent it now, but it's like $20, and I don't recommend spending $20 on it.
Yeah,
like,
I'll hold off until it's a little
bit. We justified it. We were like, well, we wanted to go see this in the theater, and this is how much it would have cost us to go see it, so we could do it at home, and we're not spending this money on going to see X. But this is definitely like a Redbox movie. You would more than get your $1.50 worth.
Okay. Fair enough. Good to know.
Yeah. And with that, we travel back to 1999 for Never Been Kissed, the romantic comedy in which a 25-year-old Drew Barrymore goes back to high school to write an undercover expose on something nobody knows, because she doesn't have a story in mind when she goes undercover to high school, which is how journalism works. She's a copy editor at the Sun-Times, sent back to high school, where she makes friends with an all-star cast of young actors and perhaps strikes up a romance with the aforementioned Michael Vartan in the film's creepiest and most problematic storyline.
Indeed.
Probably not so, where we should start.
Yeah, so I was excited when you asked me if I wanted to do a podcast about this movie, because you did not know when you asked me it, but this is the first movie I ever saw in a theater.
This is amazing.
I was very sheltered, as I've mentioned on previous episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not allowed to go to the theater, and I snuck out, and I chose my first theater movie as wisely as a 17-year-old who's been super sheltered could. I went to the Focus on the Family website, and I read the parental reviews of movies that were out at the time, and decided that this one looked like it would be the the least offensive and most fun, so I could like assuage my guilt about not telling my parents I was going to a movie where they had been quite clear that my guardian angel would be waiting outside if I went in. And I went and saw this movie about an innocent young girl who's never been kissed, which I could relate to at the time because she also sheltered. And yeah, I found it very delightful at the time. I have seen it many times since then. Drew Barrymore is somebody I will watch in most things. Rewatching it yesterday, it was definitely with different eyes than I saw it when I first saw it in a theater. But what was your first encounter with this movie?
We saw it the weekend it opened, or maybe it was a sneak preview. I remember the order being like, it was March of 99. Friday night, we saw 10 Things I Hate About You. Saturday night, we either saw Never Been Kissed as... I can't remember if it opened that weekend or if it was a sneak preview. And then Sunday night, we finally got around to seeing The Matrix. Like, I definitely saw two teen comedies before I saw The Matrix.
Yeah, so can I tell you why I did not see 10 Things I Hate About You or The Matrix in theaters that weekend, Patrick?
Why is that?
Because the Focus on the Family website informed me that 10 Things I Hate About You, while based on a Shakespeare play, which should make it wholesome, featured male genitalia being drawn on someone's face. So that's And I couldn't watch The Matrix because that had a soundtrack that included Marilyn Manson, and he was known to rip up Bibles at his concerts. So I couldn't watch that. So I decided that this was, like, the least offensive choice.
Wow. I think... In some ways, you chose wisely, and then in others, like, this is the most offensive choice in terms of messaging.
I by the way, love, love, love both 10 Things I Hate About You and The Matrix,
yeah.
And have very much regretted not seeing them in theaters, although at least now I've seen The Matrix in the theater.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I remember really liking it, and this being a little bit of like a, well, I guess The Wedding Singer was sort of the Drew Barrymore comeback. It had come out like a year or two prior, and that was sort of like, oh, hey, Drew Barrymore is back, because she had been making movies but nothing particularly big, and she was in mostly supporting roles and stuff like Bad Girls and Boys on the Side, and then The Wedding Singer kind of makes her an A-list movie star again, and this is the first time she kind of takes that out for a test drive. And as a vehicle for Drew Barrymore, I think this is a great movie. I think she gets to be really funny, really likable. I'm a big, big Drew Barrymore fan. I just like her a lot. And so, and this might be my favorite of all her stuff, because she gets to do so much and she's so at the center and she's so willing to be silly without, there's a little bit of a thing, you know, we've been talking about romantic comedies, and Katherine Heigl is a little bit guilty of this in her movies, and Jennifer Lopez is a little bit guilty of this in her movies, where it's like, they're clearly these incredible women who have everything going for them, so what flaw can we give them? Well, sometimes they fall down, you know, like, oh, Katherine Heigl, what a klutz!
I know.
And so there's a little bit of like, okay, fine, I'll do this in their performances, but they don't really commit to it. And Drew Barrymore just so fully commits to the character of Josie Geller. She transforms herself into this goofball, and she's delightful.
She is. And the thing about it is, even when she is, you know, she's made it through the dorky phase into the supposedly, like, you've transitioned into the popular girls thing, she still is pretty dorky. Like, she dresses better, but the stuff she says is still very delightfully dorky. And I love that about her. So yeah, she really sells this character. And, you know, say what you want to about how successful this movie is as a whole, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to say, this is kind of the template that, like, Mean Girls falls into a little bit. Like, you know, of the unpopular girl kind of getting one over on the popular kids and overcoming whatever obstacles, you know, high school throws at you. So had it been done before at the time, I'm sure it had. But I think this is much more successful than, like, a, you know, She's All That, for sure. And this movie definitely has like a really great cast. You've got Drew Barrymore and David Arquette playing siblings, which is fun because, yes, they were both in Scream, but they didn't exactly share screen time, right, if you've seen it. yeah, and, you know, Molly Shannon, John C. Reilly. You know, you even have Octavia Spencer in this movie, which, granted, she has a very, unfortunately, minor role where she says things like, "Damn, girl, you are a writer." which I rolled my eyes at this time, but she's bringing all she can bring to a role like that. And of course the unforgettable Gary Marshall, who I can't wait for us to talk about as the editor.
He's got wieners.
Yeah. Hot wieners.
Hot wieners. Nobody says, "Can you stop saying that?" Which I thought was unrealistic.
He just keeps talking.
yeah. And all the high school kids are played by the likes of Marley Shelton and James Franco and Jordan Ladd and Jessica Alba very early on in her career. So yeah, it's pretty packed with recognizable actors. And to the movie's credit, as you were saying about like her still being a dork even after she becomes popular, she stops hanging out with like the denominators, but I give the movie credit for not having her change. All that changes is the perception of her because of some stories that David Arquette tells. So it's really about the superficiality of the people surrounding her who are able to now sort of frame her a different way, and not because she does anything to behave any differently. Like, she's still the same dork.
Right.
They just are a little bit more oblivious to it because they've decided she's cool.
Yeah. I really thought that it was smart of the movie to, like, let Rob, her brother, be the popular one. And, you know, when she goes to him for advice, he's like, "All you need is one person.
Right.
And you're in." And, you know, I mean, it does speak to how completely artificial all the cliques and all the, you know, groups are that are looking down on her one day, and the next day she's like this mysterious hero that everybody's somehow intrigued by.
And like my turnaround on Gerard Butler, I would say in the last year or two, I've had this major turnaround on David Arquette. I never disliked David Arquette, but there was always something about him that was a little bit like a dog trying to hump your leg, or it was like, okay, I like you, take it easy. And then between the documentary You Can't Kill David Arquette and his performance in the most recent Scream, and then rewatching him in Never Been Kissed, where he's amazing,
yeah,
I was like, oh yeah, no, I really like David Arquette.
Yeah, he's really great in this. And I think, again, due to my weird upbringing, this was my first David Arquette movie. So I was always very endeared to him just based on this role of him as the kind of messed up brother who's, you know, somehow going to take pity on his sister and like help her out in a really awkward situation. And he's so fun to watch in this. He just is. So, his was maybe my favorite performance besides Drew Barrymore in this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And they managed to make him mostly avoid being a creep, because even when his 16-year-old girlfriend is sort of throwing herself at him, there's not even the hint of a temptation, really. I mean, I didn't get the impression that, you know, I mean, she's sticking her leg up in the air. It's so weird. This movie's so weird. But rather than him being like, I'm tempted, he's just like, all right, I'm going to go get some punch and I'll come back and we'll dance. Like,
yeah,
he's exactly. Not a creep about it. I think he has one line, as do several male actors in this movie, about like, damn, these are high school girls. Like, all right, take it easy, movie.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some underage hotties on our hands line was like a real,
yeah. But again, in 1999, I feel like we just didn't think anything of it. It's so bizarre how much the times have changed and how much more aware we are of certain things and how like just oblivious we were. And I think for me, you know, obviously I think it was different for you. For me, I think so much of it comes from being raised on movies. And I was just like, yeah, that's just how things are. Like, yeah, of course a 25-year-old can go back to high school and hang out with teenagers and maybe date the teacher, because that's what happens in the movies. And now you watch and you're like, oh, this is wrong on so many levels, and there's so many weird things happening because we have just so much better awareness of things like this. And again, I still enjoy this movie. I'm not judging it. Like, I'm pointing out stuff that's weird about it. It's not a deal breaker for me. I could still put this on and have a good time with it. I admit to cringing a lot through every Michael Vartan scene. Yes. And part of that is I don't get Michael Vartan. You're a woman. Please explain Michael Vartan to me.
I wish I could. I, even when I watched this movie, did not find him dreamy at all.
No.
I don't know. He looks like, he kind of looks like he should be on like a daytime soap maybe. I don't know. He's not. Yeah. I don't get it. I don't want to like say anything bad about the way he looks. It's just the way he presents himself. He has a strange persona.
And yeah. He's inappropriate from the jump. Like,
yes. The second she walks into his classroom, he like locks eyes with her.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's just weird. Yeah. And it's funny because the movie sort of tries to have it both ways by like hemming and hawing about, is she going to do a story about how this teacher is like hitting on his student, but then they don't really do anything with that.
Right.
Because she like is in love with him. And so she couldn't do that to him and et cetera. but yeah, I was just laughing to myself. I was like, film Twitter would have destroyed this movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And then there's other things that, like, you know, in 1999, we accepted that, like, oh, Lily Sobieski is good at math and therefore an outcast. Instead of now in 2022, I feel like Lily Sobieski is good at math and a gorgeous model. She's the total package, you know, like,
she kind of is like the hottest person in this movie. I don't understand. Even then I remember thinking like, she's really pretty though. She's just wearing glasses.
Like, well, that's the kiss of death right there.
Glasses equal ugly. I don't get it.
Well, and thankfully we've just kind of done a turnaround where somebody who is maybe, you know, quote unquote nerdy can still be cool, you know? Yeah. And so I feel like even Giuseppe Andrews would be like well-liked and popular, even though he is quote-unquote nerdy and on the math team. Like, that's part of it too, is they cast these really attractive actors who are like unique and interesting. And it's like, no, these kids now would be running the school, you know? Totally. And in 99, we just accepted that like, well, they like math. They must be total misfits.
Right. So here's what I was going to ask you, Patrick, because I never actually had a normal high school experience, obviously, and you have gone to high school and have been around high school students by virtue of you and your wife's professions. Is it anything like this?
I mean, yes, I wore a hidden camera every day. Yeah. In terms of what? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that I think is funny about the movie is the way that Raja Gosnell sort of heightens everything. Mm-hmm. So, like, when they announce the theme as the millennium and the entire school cheers, I think it's supposed to be funny because that's not a particularly inspired or original idea. And so later in the movie, when it turns out that, like, oh, another school has also chosen the millennium and they're so distraught that you think they just got the worst news. So the movie seems to be having a lot of fun at high schoolers' expense without ever veering into full on like merciless Heathers territory.
Sure.
So was it like this in terms of what?
Well, okay. I guess I mean mostly the disparity between like the popular kids and the outcast kids. Like, it seems pretty vicious, and I know kids can be. And I know there's been a lot of work about, like, anti-bullying, but Do you feel like the cliques were ever this pronounced?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I existed in my own bubble. I had my own group of friends, and I was fortunate enough to be able to move a little bit fluidly. Like, I knew some popular kids and could be friendly with them. I knew some, you know, of the, like, kids in the honors classes and could be friendly with them, but I was mostly in, like, theater and choir, and I was in all that shit. So you'd have to ask somebody who was the Giuseppe Andrews in high school, you know, and who's like, oh, yeah, people were horrible to me. Right. I didn't see a ton of it, and people were not necessarily horrible to me, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Yeah. All I can really, because I'm around high schoolers in the sense of like speech team, I help with speech,
right?
Speech circuit, but those kids are, you know, they're participating in an academic activity that is sort of theater adjacent, so it's probably not the most representative archetypes, I guess. But they all seem, you know, well adjusted and fine. Like, I don't know. But that the part about it where like people are throwing eggs at each other and right. like there's this whole hoax of like her. You know, her crush asks her to prom and then, like, completely humiliates her, almost Carrie style.
Right.
Is, like, I don't know. It doesn't exactly ring true, but I guess the whole point is, like, kids are mean and high school sucks. And I guess that's kind of what's at the heart of this.
Yeah, and again, that's the thesis of so many movies that are set in high school, you know? And that's part yeah. of what I meant earlier, where like, I didn't question things because my worldview was shaped by John Hughes. And right. so it's just like, yeah, this is how things are. And even if it didn't necessarily jive with my own high school experience, it's like, but this is movie high school. And like Erica always talks about a friend that she has that truly believed everything she saw in movies and like truly believed about like social strata and different classes in high school. And, you know, wanting to be part of the popular group and doing whatever it takes to sort of get there. And Erica was always popular without having to try very hard. She just, mm-hmm. her whole thing was she was nice to everyone.
Right.
And that made her well-liked and popular. So it's very funny to hear her talk about this friend who, like, worked so hard at it. And I didn't, cause I just didn't, I was kind of unaware and I didn't totally care. You know, there was no yeah. part of me that was like, oh, I dream of being popular.
Yeah. It does seem like it's the premise of so many movies that I guess there's something, you know, there's something there, whether we're talking about Heathers or this or Mean Girls or,
right.
you know, something that would come out now. But yeah, it's just an interesting obsession. And the fact that it, you know, is still making her like throw up at the age of 25, you know, is kind of crazy. But
why does this movie, she's 25, so let's say she had gone to high school 7 years earlier, that would have made her 18. Mm-hmm. So that would have been 92. Why does this movie act like she went to high school in 1985?
I wondered that too, because like the outfits and the music
yeah.
and the hairstyles are all very, very 80s
yeah.
in the movie. Yeah, it was weird. I don't know. Her prom dress from the flashbacks is like...
Right, and it's yikes. Playing like Cyndi Lauper and Cutting Crew.
Yes, exactly. And I don't think it's because she's unhip for liking that stuff or dressing that way. I think it seems like other people in the school dress...
Right.
In a similar fashion. So, yeah, I don't know. That was a weird one.
Part of me was, like, feeling like it was the movie trying to code her as being older.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's less, the Michael Vartan stuff is less weird.
Yeah, maybe. Although, it's hard for me to figure out. I was trying to figure out how old do we think he's supposed to be.
He's got to be in his 30s, right?
Like, yeah, I would think so. I mean, certainly the fiance or not fiance, I don't know, girlfriend that we're introduced to of his certainly looks like she's in her 30s. So,
yeah.
And the fact that he refers to like Gordie Howe, I don't know anything about hockey.
I don't either.
I've come to realize that he was a famous hockey player in like the 80s or something.
Right.
So I do think he's like supposed to be maybe a decade older than the kids he's teaching. So... Yeah, it's not completely clear how much older he is than the rest of them. But, yeah, definitely odd. The other thing I always find hilarious is her first job out of college is at the Sun-Times. And she's a copy editor, but she has her own office.
Yeah.
Most of the reporters are just, like, out on the floor. So I don't know how she got her own office and an assistant, the derpiest assistant ever, but still an assistant. At the age of 25 without having ever written like an actual article. I don't know, but good for her.
Yeah.
So
why does she want to be a journalist so bad? It's like, you've got it made. Why are you
yes.
trying to go back to high school for presumably months when you don't have a story?
Yes. I mean, clearly newspapers had a lot more money to to throw around back then. But then again, you know, they were apparently firing people at every meeting that they ever had. So
watching this yesterday, I mean, just like the shots of Chicago, Erica was just freaking out, or like the shot of the newsroom, the Sun Times building, all these things that like, oh, none of this exists anymore.
Doesn't exist anymore. I know. It's so weird. And it's funny. So I, one of the ones I didn't mention of the, have you seen anything good lately, is I rewatched Broadcast News, and the contrast between Broadcast News and the news that goes on in this movie is kind of hilarious. It's quite the dichotomy.
Well, I remember in 99, I feel like my biggest problem with this movie was that when she does write her story, it ended up in the Showcase section of the Sun Times. And I was a devoted Sun Times reader at this point. And Showcase where like was where Roger Ebert would run his reviews, and they would write about TV shows and stuff. Like, nothing about her story lends itself to the Showcase section. And I remember being like, this movie knows nothing about journalism. Completely skipping over the part about the teacher and the student. Why was that my issue with this movie in 1999? Right.
Well, understandable, because that also doesn't make sense. But, you know, I mean, they had to run it somewhere, and it wasn't sure. exactly an expose. So, yeah. I just like the idea of her getting paid to spend a semester in high school and everybody in the office just watching videotapes of her all day. So,
right.
Clearly, there were several months where the paper just wasn't going out.
Nobody's. I do like the, like, quietly burgeoning romance between John C. Reilly and Molly Shannon. I think that's pretty cute.
It is.
I like David Arquette landing as the assistant coach on the baseball team. I thought that was a nice touch. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of good stuff in this movie. There's just also some really weird stuff that we didn't really question as a society at the time.
Yeah. Watching it again and seeing the scene where, and it's played as a romantic scene, but the scene where Michael Vartan gets on the Ferris wheel with Josie and, you know, they start talking about her future, and he tells her that in the future, like, guys will be lined up around the block. And she's like, oh, you have to say that because you're my teacher. And he's like, no, I shouldn't say that because I'm your teacher. I'm like,
yeah.
You should stop talking now.
Finally, and somebody with some self-awareness.
Yeah. But yes, it's got some really, like, beautifully shot stuff, too. I really did enjoy a lot of the – I know that the scenes in the high schools were all shot in California, so there's no authenticity there. But I did enjoy seeing – at least the establishing shots of Chicago, like that stuff was really fun. And I also this time really enjoyed all of the fashion because, of course, like 2000s fashion is coming back in style. And I noticed in looking it up that the costume designer also did all the costumes for Clueless and for Romy and Michelle. So she has a really her name's Mona May. She has a really good eye for the fashion of the youth.
Yeah, you can almost see some similarities across those three movies.
Yeah.
In terms of the aesthetic and the definitely, obviously, the clothing. That's really interesting. I didn't put that together.
Yeah, and she, I think what she does very well is that she takes you through the story of the character and the character's arc just kind of using clothing because it's so important to this character that she starts out dressing like completely, you know, out of step with all the younger people.
The and feather then boa.
The feather boa, the white jeans that she, of course, spills chocolate milk on because, of course. And, and then, like, as you kind of go through the movie, she gets more and more trendy, but then ultimately kind of turns into a little bit more kind of classic and timeless looks. And so it's like she starts to care a little bit less about that surfacey stuff and the real version of herself comes out. So yeah, I think really great job on the costumes in this movie.
Yeah, there's a great gag where, again, rather than adapting to her friend's style, she gets them to adapt to her, where they all end up buying cardigans.
Yes! Exactly.
Which is a really funny joke, you know.
It is, totally. Yeah. I really enjoyed seeing that. It was fun to see James Franco get rebuffed when he tries to kiss someone at the end. Like, the girl that he's trying to kiss, yeah, just hits him with a purse, and I was like, yeah. Yeah.
Good for you, Marley Shelton. Don't take any of that shit.
Exactly. yeah, so that was fun. I was trying to figure out if South Glen South, which is the name of this movie, was a stand-in for any particular high school in the Chicago area, but the closest I could come was like Glenbard East, but I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple Glenbards, obviously. I don't know which of the Glenbards it's meant to be, but that was the closest I could come up with, too.
Yeah.
Oh, shit, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, in drawing more parallels to Mean Girls, I noticed a lot more this time watching it than I had in the past. So, in addition to the aforementioned denominators, which there's a mathletes team in Mean Girls, there's also a cool word. Rufus is the word that Guy is trying to make popular, and he critiques people who use it wrong. And then, of course, you know, you have Fetch in Mean Girls, but of course that one, they're like, stop trying to make Fetch happen. It's never going to happen.
Right, right.
I enjoyed the attempt at making up a cool new word.
Yeah, there's a couple of them that they use throughout the movie. Again, it's not like the most sharply satirical movie, but there is a streak of satire that runs through it, which I like. I like that as soon as David Arquette shows up, he becomes the most popular kid in school simply by eating an entire bucket of coleslaw.
I know. That makes me gag every time. I do like coleslaw, but the idea of eating a whole bucket is disgusting.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not even coleslaw. It's coleslaw food.
Yeah, exactly. Spelled with a K. So, I should also note that anytime somebody says I'm nauseous in real life, I always immediately go back to Josie correcting and saying, you mean nauseated, right, not nauseous. So, yeah, I always think of that when I think of this movie.
I don't, you know, because early on they attempt to make her sort of an outcast, I guess, because she is kind of like a word dork. And has, like, brown hair? I don't know. Like, when she's working as a copy editor at 25 at the Sun-Times with her own office and assistant, as you point out, like, and she's Drew fucking Barrymore, why are we pretending, like, she doesn't have everything going for her?
Yeah, I feel like a little bit in this movie, it's less about how she looks and more about her personality.
Okay.
Because she is a little socially unaware, I would say. you know, she's constantly correcting people's grammar. And
right.
She seems like she's a little obsessive about things most people could care less about. And for a 25-year-old, she has a bit of a distorted idea of what love and romance should or will be like because she's never experienced it. And so, you know, she has this very, like, glassy-eyed look on her face and, like, almost starts tearing up just describing like her fantasy version of a kiss, which is like, you know, she's 25 years old and everybody else is like, all right, come on, like, we're all talking about our exploits at the office and who, you know, Molly Shannon is doing it with this week, and you're talking about how you've never even been kissed by someone. So, you know, I think it's partly that, just like that social awkwardness, and then they do try to have it manifest in the way that she dresses and her hair and, you know, that kind of stuff is the movie.
Well, and the movie just sort of confirms her ideas about love and romance rather than suggesting, like, no, there's a reality that you need to come to, or at least meet halfway. Instead, it's like, no, you get the whole fantasy. You're alone on the baseball field with an audience of people cheering you on and news crews filming you with your 35-year-old former teacher.
Yes. And I'm just going to go ahead and say, like, if it's your first time kissing someone, even if you have kissed someone before, you probably don't want the first one to be, like, in the middle of the spotlight on a big screen. Like, you've got to figure out the rhythms. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, it's just an odd choice but she was trying to help her brother out. So I guess that's why the baseball stadium. I don't know. It makes sense in a movie kind of way.
Right.
I also, some random observations. I enjoyed I could grab a bull's balls. I enjoyed that line. I say that times. You don't think I could grab a bull's balls? And I also enjoyed that she has, like, 9 or 10 needlepoint pillows on her bed, and she's, you know, they're attempting to make her look like a crazy cat lady, but she only has one cat and some turtles. Like,
right.
It could be worse. And did you notice that Andrew Wilson plays a
I did.
High school?
I so did. Was this
cameo.
Would this have been at the point that she was dating Luke Wilson?
I think so.
Okay.
I was trying to figure that out too. I think this would have been because she had probably recently done what's that weird movie
Home
that
Fries.
Her and Luke Wilson are in. That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, she would have recently done that. So I think they probably met somehow that way.
So maybe that's how the other Wilson. And Roger in Op-Ed is played by Alan Covert from Grandma's Boy.
Yes.
And many an Adam Sandler movie.
Many an Adam Sandler movie. Yes, very true. And Sean Whalen is the derpy assistant
the
who
douchey
says
assistant.
Things like, power is powerful, put down on a t-shirt. Yeah. So he doesn't seem very good at his assistant job, but nonetheless.
What happened to Lily Sobieski? Why did she disappear?
I heard somewhere that she like decided she was over the whole acting thing, but I don't know if that stuck. I'm trying to think of like the last movie I remember seeing her in, because I tried to kind of watch her stuff as it was coming out right after this. I remember seeing her in Eyes Wide Shut, much different movie than this. And I remember Here on Earth, which is not a good movie.
I saw that opening night. Don't worry.
Yeah, it's her and Chris Klein.
She's in Joyride.
Joyride. My First Mister, which is actually a really great little movie, and it has Albert Brooks kind of befriending her. They work at the mall together, and John Goodman is in it, so that's a fun one. The Glass House is the last one I really remember her being in, and that was, if I remember correctly, not very good.
Okay.
Yeah,
Wikipedia says she retired from acting in 2012 to focus on her art career.
Oh, okay. Well, good for her.
Yeah. I thought it was just like she read that terrible 9/11 poem and then nobody wanted to cast her anymore.
Yeah. But... Well, you know. Oh, yeah. She was also in that Max movie where... Wasn't that the one where John Cusack plays Hitler?
He doesn't play Hitler, but he, like, befriends Hitler?
He's friends with Hitler. That's
yeah.
it. Okay.
Yeah. I never saw it.
I just remember at one point he asks Hitler if he wants lemonade, and I remember thinking that was absurd and kind of funny.
Because Hitler was an iced tea drinker.
Well, clearly.
Right.
Maybe more of an Arnold Palmer man. I don't know. Hard to say. But yes, I liked Lily Sobieski. I wish that she had done a little bit more stuff, but she's great in this movie in the little bit that we get to see her.
Again, because you get sucked into the movie and you forget that, like, there's this age difference between them, because as actors, they're probably a lot closer in age.
Mm-hmm.
In her scenes with Drew Barrymore, there was a moment where I allowed myself to be fooled into, like, better movie, these two fall in love. And then I'm like, wait, no, she's 25.
But
that girl's still a high school student.
Exactly.
And I pulled back on that real, real quick. But I was just like, they seem to have better chemistry than her and Michael Vartan.
Totally. I think most people would have better chemistry than anybody in Michael Vartan. I could see that. Yeah, and I mean, it's not like we would want her to get together with any of the people she works with, because besides John C. Reilly, I would say most of them don't seem particularly like a catch for her.
Right, no.
What is up, by the way, speaking of people she works with the guy that's job is just to sit in a van
right?
with like all the surveillance equipment and occasionally bring his girlfriend by to like watch stuff and... make out or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. While she gets high on pot brownies.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, this movie is fun.
And what is the club in Chicago where the reggae band is playing and high school students and teachers both hang out and drink beer and get high?
Yeah, that was a mystery to me as well.
Okay.
It did not look familiar, and also that scenario seems very unrealistic.
I'm not aware. When he bumps into, you know, when she bumps into Michael Vartan, it's like, what? Where is this mythical place?
It is magical for sure. Yes. Where Ozzy Motley plays the band on the stage.
Right. And Josie gets high off her ass.
She does. Speaking of music, though, this does have a pretty good soundtrack. I hadn't remembered how much actual good music is in this, because I don't know, a lot of 1999 movies, particularly teen movies, not the best soundtracks, like sure. very dated soundtracks. This one has the Beach Boys, it has De La Soul, it has an early Jimmy Eat World song. It has Please, Please, Please Let Me Get What I Want by the Smiths before that was like super popular to put in movies. There's a lot of really good stuff. Shebop.
It's got a good Hole song. It's got
a Cardigan song that isn't Love played.
It's got the one song I think I liked off of Up by R.E.M. That song, yep. At My Most Beautiful. I don't think I liked that record very much, but At My Most Beautiful is really pretty.
It's a really pretty song. That's one of my favorite R.E.M. songs, actually. So, yeah, really good soundtrack. I don't know if I ever bought the soundtrack. This was around the time when I was buying soundtracks to movies I hadn't seen as a way to feel more connected to them. but I don't remember if I bought the soundtrack for this movie. Probably not, because I probably would still have it. Yeah, it was fun to revisit this because for all of its issues, it's still a pretty, like, mostly wholesome feeling movie that, while parts of it are ridiculous, was really fun.
Yeah, agreed. And it's fun to talk about. And again, I don't want to get too deep into the, you know, the problematic stuff. We can acknowledge it and just say, like, it makes no sense. And it's a weird, creepy subplot in a movie that probably didn't need a creepy subplot. But it's almost like she could have, you know, met an adult outside of teaching or outside of the school and been carrying on a relationship with that adult while also going to high school during the day and trying to lead a double life or something. Like, just a way of avoiding her romancing a teacher. But what can we do? Right.
Or at least, like, at the very, very least, if she's going to be playing the high school student who's in love with the teacher, like, could we make her 18 and not 17? Like, would that have been so hard?
Right.
I don't know. I mean,
still weird, though. Still weird, even if she's 18.
Like, I don't know. Anyway, what would have been your ideal outcome if you're rewriting this movie now?
Yeah.
Like, you still have this subplot of the teacher being a creeper. How do you resolve it? What's your preferred ending?
Yeah, I don't know. Again, if they're making this movie in 2022, I feel like it ends up looking more like something like Pretty Persuasion, where it's just super dark.
Yeah.
I don't know how you make the glossy version of what transpires in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like she would have to stay single, and of course nobody wants that in a movie where she's like pining for romance. And I also can't see her actually writing an article about the teacher being creepy. And then them later getting together, like, that doesn't seem plausible.
Right.
It's a tough one to resolve for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe she falls in love with like the senior baseball coach. I don't know. But then he's also a staff member, so never mind.
Yeah, no, it doesn't work. Right. If there's a way to somehow never suggest that Michael Vartan is into her or like any possibility of romance, and then after it's all outed or whatever, then she reintroduces herself and says, hey, I'm Josie Geller, I'm 25, I work at the Sun Times. And he's like, oh, nice to meet you, Josie Geller. You know what I mean? And like, now we can start from here without ever introducing the notion that he's sort of into her. But they just don't have the real estate to deal with all that. I don't think there's not enough time.
They require like a massive exposition dump in the form of conversation, which is usually not successful. So
no.
I don't know. It's a special movie with its flaws that exists in a time where this was allowed.
Right.
It's hard to imagine this coming out now and being as, I think it was a pretty big success, right? I
mean,
it
did
well at the box office. I don't know if it was like
number one.
Matrix, I'm sure, was number one, but
it made about $85 million on a budget of $25 million. So yeah, it did well.
Yeah. Got its money back and then some. That's good. So yeah, I mean, I would recommend this movie. You have to know, of course, the caveats, but I would definitely recommend it because if nothing else, it's just fun to see all of these people who you now recognize from so many other things interacting, even in like somewhat ridiculous scenarios.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. And it's also the first Flower Films
movie,
which gave us Donnie Darko. So
it did give us Donnie Darko, another wonderful Drew Barrymore movie, where she is in high school, but she's playing a teacher in that one.
And she's all like, sit next to the boy you think is the cutest.
Exactly.
Which is a weird thing for a teacher to do, so she's still problematic. She's
problematic. Well, she gets fired in that one.
Oh, so. That's right.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
And I love Drew Barrymore. Like I said, I would watch her in most things. It's funny because I also recently watched Poison Ivy, which I hadn't seen before.
Oh, very nice.
And it's funny to see, like, that version of Drew Barrymore, right, which is, you know, this, like, evil temptress type.
Right.
And then this is, like, so very different. And then I realized, oh, like, people who knew about Drew in the 90s knew she was, like, this troubled teen, so maybe it was harder to swallow her as this innocent in this movie, but I don't know, maybe not, because The Wedding Singer, like you said, had probably, like, rehabbed that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that really was the turning point, because for a lot of the 90s, she was doing more of those kinds of Poison Ivy. She played Amy Fisher in, like, a TV or a cable movie. She was in a movie called Doppelganger, where she was playing, like, a dark character. She was in a pseudo-remake of Gun Crazy, where she played kind of a dark character.
You did see that. That was good.
Yeah. So, yeah, it really was The Wedding Singer that was like, oh, now she's America's sweetheart.
Mm-hmm. And she's pretty much stayed in that vein, I feel like, for the most part since then. In the movies I've seen, you know, she was in Charlie's Angels, which I actually really love.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, 51st Dates, and I sort of like Fever Pitch, even though I realize it's not probably a good movie.
I'm with you there.
Whippet, I love. So, yeah, I mean,
Whippet's great. I wish she would direct more movies.
Yeah, maybe we'll get her some more, or maybe she'll do some more directing in the next few years. I would love that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking about this movie with me. It was super fun.
Absolutely. And thanks for talking about this movie, even though you had COVID.
I'm going to go sleep now. But thank you guys very much for listening. As always, you can find our stuff every day at fthismovie.com. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, or you can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again, Rosalie.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.